Hello, everyone. Welcome to another Newsmakers podcast. Today, we're talking with Ken Haynes, who is the CEO of The Wrench Group, which operates in 25 markets across 14 states. We're going to talk about the HVAC mergers and acquisition market. Thanks for taking the time today, Ken.
Hey, thanks for having me, Kyle. Happy to be here.
Now, you started off as a technician, is that right?
That is true. A long time ago. I hate to admit just how many years ago, but yeah, I've been in this business since I'm 15 years old, so a little over 45 years. But yeah, started out with the trade school and learned the HVAC and major appliance repair trade, and graduated high school and went right into business in the HVAC trade. So yeah, okay. As a technician, doing it for a long time.
And then, if you don't mind, talk a little bit before we get to the wrench group, the jump from technician to business owner. What made you do that, and how was that transition?
You know, it's a great question. People ask me that all the time. And I've got kids. I've got a 20-year-old right now who's in college trying to figure out what he wants to be. And people say, how did you know at the age of 15 that you wanted to get into the air conditioning business? Like a kid growing up in the Northeast where most folks didn't even have central air conditioning back where I grew up in those days in the late 70s, early 80s. They had wall units, right? And so I don't know. I knew I wanted to be an entrepreneur, and I was always good with my hands. And my father was always very handy. He was always building stuff and fixing stuff. And so I don't know, but back in those days, you know, and gosh, we need it today. Trade schools, high schools offered trade schools within, and it was a 2-year course. And we so as an industry so desperately need that now. And I decided to sign up for it. You know, I still had intended to go to college. My parents wanted me to go to college as well, but I did so well that I said, look, I want to be an entrepreneur. I've learned the space. True, I don't know much about business, but I'll learn on the fly. How hard can it be? And so, you know, I did that, and it was very successful. And not to make a, you know, short story long, but I ended up meeting someone in the space about 5 years into it, and I ended up selling my business long before selling your business and this trade became what it is today. Right. And I sold it, went to work for him. So, you know, it was easy for me. I had some help along the way. I mean, my career, so I grew up in New York. I went to trade school, started a business, sold it to somebody I met, worked for him, helped him build his business. He had a young kid in the trade as well. And I knew that ultimately it would be his company. Right. And so I relocated to Florida, and I figured is no better place to do air conditioning than the Florida market.
Right.
And so I relocated to Florida and ended up working for a business that was owned by Roto-Rooter. And so big company. And I know, you know who Roto-Rooter is, still
sure.
Probably the largest plumbing business in the world. And, you know, I got some formal training from them, you know, things around management and leadership and finance and accounting and stuff like that. So I learned along the way, but I was just gifted, perhaps just, you know, a lot of common sense. And I just grasped things. And so it was a fairly easy transition for me. It felt right. I didn't go from a technician to running a $30 million business, right? I mean, it was, you know, 15 years in between of doing other things.
Some steps along the way, right?
Yeah, it was pretty natural for me. And and learned along the way, sure.
So what made you start the Wrench Group? I guess talk us what year that was and kind of what your goal was when you started.
Yeah, you know, another long conversation. So I maybe just prior to that, in 2003, I was working for Blue Dot, which is a consolidator, one of the consolidators back in the 90s, where it didn't end so well. And I was a regional VP of operations and reporting to the president of Blue Dot. And we had bought a business in Atlanta called Cool-Ray, which had been around since 1966, a lot of new construction, but also had a smaller retail arm. And I joined Blue Dot, and shortly thereafter, when we acquired Cool-Ray, it wasn't doing so well. So they relocated me from Florida to Atlanta to fix it. And I had spent 5 years here running the business, trying to fix the business while I was running a region at the same time. And in 2003, Blue Dot's parent went bankrupt. It was a Midwestern utility company based in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. And I happen to be sitting here. Blue Dot, rather than package Blue Dot up and sell it in one piece, they sold it off in pieces. So my phone rang and they said, hey, would you like to buy the Kure business? And I thought about it for about 2 seconds, if that long, and said, I'm in. And so I ended up buying the business from my employer in 2003. It was doing around $5 million or so at the time. We had shut down the new construction piece, which was really not our sweet spot and wasn't doing well. It was bleeding. And so I was left with a $5 million retail, break-fix model, service replacement, and grew that business over the next 12, 13 years. To jump ahead, around late 2015, a friend of mine, Paul Kelly, who owned a company called Parker & Sons, Alan O'Neill at Abacus in Houston, we came together and packaged the business up. We hired a banker and presented it to private equity. It was really the beginning of private equity in the space. So we sold it to a PE firm called Investcorp, based in New York, in March of 2016. And they appointed me CEO in July of 16. And, you know, the rest is history. We've been doing it now for 6 years, and we're on our third private equity flip. And so, you know, it makes sense. It was, these were three like-minded businesses that came together. We were certainly not integrated. We weren't a platform. We tried to package it up as if we were. It took InvestCorp about a half a second to figure out just that. But they saw something in us, and we had a lot of success. These businesses had great leadership, great cultures, and great markets, which is a lot of kind of how we think about things going forward as we do M&A, and somewhat of a differentiated model. And, we learned from best practices, and the business has taken off. And that's our model still. And, it's worked out really well. And a lot of folks have come along for the ride. And, you know, back in the day where we had a few hundred employees, we're now over 6,000 employees in 6 years. So wow. It's been a lot of fun and a great ride.
What did you see in the HVC market that it seems like you were on the front end of the trend? So obviously you had a little forward thinking. What do you see in the HVC market that said, yeah, no, this would work here? Because you kind of referenced that it didn't work well in the 90s we all know about. So I guess the two points, what did you see and what was learned to make sure that the problems don't happen again?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you know, one of the things, if we learned anything from the first iteration, was we learned what not to do. Mm-hmm. It was a very different time, different place. The strategy back in those days was, you know, an ARS was one of the first. It was to go in, buy these businesses. We didn't do a great job on diligence. And so it was this frenzy to buy companies, get them in, suck the life out, you know, change cultures, change names, get rid of all the autonomy, watch, you know, all the entrepreneurship sucked out of them, and then go public. It just didn't work for a lot of those reasons. Managers and owners didn't stay. They became disenfranchised. It wasn't fun anymore. We impacted people on the front lines. It just didn't work. And so our model is very, very different. And most of private equity that's in this space now, I think a lot of the models are very similar in that, you know, we don't centralize for the sake of centralization. There's a fair amount of standardization, and we're building a real business. It's not as if we're a federation of companies across the country. You still have to have a real company, right? And checks and balances. And so we do that, but we don't change names, right? Because local brands are really what matters. Right. Having a national brand really, it just doesn't mean anything. To consumers, for the most part, they'd rather work with local and think it's local anyway. Yep. And we keep things fun. And so we focus, you know, we partner with companies that are very successful at what they do already. And so we know as we partner and acquire, we're not going to go in and have to fix a broken business. We're partnering because what they do is working, right? They have long track records of success. They have great cultures, great teams, well-organized. We don't want to go in and turn that upside down. We like to pour you know, jet fuel on a raging fire. How do we make them even better? Mm-hmm. Right. And there's some change, clearly. There's some integration, but you know, businesses that are successful do things really good at the local level. To take it all back at corporate and centralize for the sake of doing it just doesn't work. And doesn't make a lot of sense to me in us. And so that's kind of how we think about it. It was very different back in the 90s and early 2000s. Everything was centralized. Owners left. They didn't stay. You know, with Wrench Group, as we partner with a company, the owners stay on board. They roll equity. They've got skin in the game, right? And they still have fun. They're still running their business. Right. With some non-negotiables, some change. But for the most part, they're still doing what they did every day. And it's still fun. And so I think that's a big differentiator for us.
Gotcha. So what are you looking for in a company? You're talking about, you know, you want to put the gas on the already burning fire. It's obviously profitable companies that are doing well, but I'm assuming there's a culture aspect to this as well to see if they fit with you guys, or is it strictly just a financial look?
No, I know. I think obviously financial is important. I mean, it drives price, obviously, right? So that always works. And we want to partner with businesses that have strong, want to have a strong track record of top line and bottom line growth, but also they have very organized books, right? I mean, not a lot of adjustments, and the books are ticked and tied and in good shape. But first and foremost, we want to partner with great companies in great markets that have strong cultures and management teams. We look at depth of management to make sure that, you know, we've got folks that ultimately owners do leave and retire. We've got to make sure that we've got good succession management and planning around that. But really, first and foremost, is partnering with really, really good businesses, and we dig in and do a lot of work around those areas to make sure that it hits. And so for us, the first thing we want to do before we really go anywhere and before a process goes anywhere is to meet the owner or owners, go out and have dinner, make sure that we're a good fit for them, make sure that they're a good fit for us. Everyone understands kind of what things look like post-close. So there's no surprises. Here's kind of how we operate. Here's how we think about things. Here's what life looks like. And we just want to make sure that it's going to be a good fit. We're going to be part, and we're partners. And because they all roll equity, we do look at it. We look at it as a partnership. I mean, we operate as an LLC, and they are partners. And so there's a lot of work that goes in, you know, first and foremost, but ultimately, you know, culture is important. And we do everything in our power to not impact local culture, especially the frontline people who are driving the business day in, day out. There's a little bit of impact to folks in accounting and HR for obvious reasons, where, you know, we moved our bank accounts and there's things around, you know, fiduciary that changes. But we're super careful to not impact local cultures.
And then from that first dinner to when they're a part of your organization, how long of a process is that? I'm sure it varies a little bit business to business, but just kind of ballpark it for me if you don't mind.
Yeah, it depends on size, but typically it's anywhere from 60 to 90 days, depending upon, you know, how fast the sellers want to move, you know, their bandwidth to get through diligence quickly. We can move as, you know, again, it depends on the size of the business as well, but typically 60 to 90 days.
Okay, that's the average. Yeah. That's quicker than I thought it would be. That's interesting. And then what are you looking for contractors listening to this? Say, geez, I wonder if my business is in the place where someone would want to acquire it. What are a few benchmarks that maybe you look at before you look at anything else on the numbers side to think, yeah, you know, this is be a fit. This is a good business, be it profitability or what have you.
Well, first and foremost, we want to make sure, you know, culturally we align. We think about things the same. That our strategy, our vision lines up with the owner's strategy and vision, where they want to go, where they want to take their business, how can we help them along those routes. And then I think it's everything else. And it's a typical due diligence around strength of management, strength of books, adjustments, their EBITDA. We pay off of a multiple of EBITDA, earnings before income tax, depreciation, amortization. So there's a lot of work around if they're open to it, and we can, you have conversations with other folks in the organization. Sometimes that's allowed, sometimes it's not, dependent upon, you know, who's under the tent at the location. And certainly we want to be respectful of that. But it just starts out where we go through every area of the business, operations, see how they operate, and dig in and get under the covers.
Okay. And then obviously, you know, things have been rocking and rolling in the HVAC industry for a few years. And actually, I think some contractors I talked to were just shocked at the amount that their company was being valued at. But as we interest rates are going up, and I know everyone's kind of a little concerned about the economy, how do you see that affecting this HVAC trend, if at all?
Yeah, you know, I think it's starting to impact a little bit. I think it's still fairly robust. And we're starting to see, you know, the pace in which deals are getting done slow up a little bit. You're right. I mean, interest rates have gone up. It becomes less attractive. It's more difficult to raise debt. The cost of that debt and capital has gone up significantly over the past several years. And certainly that is impacting some of the bigger deals. I think so. There seems to be, you know, from the private equity side, a little bit of a slowdown, not as aggressive, less knife fights, if you will, less folks, you know, bidding for the same business as the cost of that capital has increased. But, you know, especially for the larger businesses, we're starting to see some of that. But the deals are still getting done. My gut tells me that, you know, we'll see things continue to slow up a little bit over the next 12 to 24 months, but private equity loves the space. And as you know, Kyle, the space is so big. And if you look at how much private equity owns today, it's still, you know, between HVAC, plumbing, and electrical anyway, they'll call it $130 billion across the country. Private equity owns less than 10% of that. Call it $10 billion to be generous. And so there's just so much white space and so much opportunity, and it's such a great industry, non-discretionary in nature. You know, it's I wouldn't say it's recession proof, but it's certainly recession resistant. People need what we do, and that's great to be essential. But I do think we're going to see, depending upon how the economy goes, I think we're going to see things continue to slow down a little and then come back, you know, over the next 12 or 24 months, but deals are still getting done. I think the pace has just slowed up some.
Okay. So besides, a good point on semi-recession proof, and as COVID taught us, you know, essential for the American public. But what else does private equity see in HVAC that makes it so attractive? I'm guessing a little bit because it's such a fragmented industry. There's an opportunity there as well. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, it's fragmented in nature. I mean, I'll give you an example. You could own a $200 million business in Atlanta and have less than 10% market share, right? And it's a pretty big business. It's very, very fragmented, still dominated largely by independently owned mom and pops. But the essential nature, non-discretionary, not tied. We're not doing new constructions. It's all break, fix, maintenance, service, replacement. You're not tied much to the economy. And you know, while, you know, things could shift a little bit. I mean, people may make a decision to not buy the big expensive replacement system and shift towards fixing or repairing for a bit. Ultimately, that comes back. And so it's very, very steady and growing. And it has, you know, decades long history of doing really well. And even if, you know, industry's been growing at 20-25% organically, while we don't expect that to continue, it certainly will grow at 8-10-12-15, which is significantly better than what we see in the economy overall, the GDP. Right. And so it's just a great space. And, you know, like we like to say, you know, toilets break during recessions, right? Water heaters break in recessions. Lights go out in recessions. Air conditioners, heaters, they break. And so the non-discretionary aspect of the business, they just love. And we all do.
Right. Because you guys do, you know, HVAC, plumbing, and electrical?
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And then what... How do you find the contractors, I guess? Are you just looking at a specific market that you think, oh, there's a good opportunity here, and let's find the best guy in Atlanta? Or is it the other way around, where you're looking at the contractor and then figuring out the market?
You know, we've got a pipeline in certain set of markets that we're focused in or on. And, you know, for us, we don't, we've got a couple of folks on the M&A team, but we're not very aggressive in that. You'll never get a piece of mail in your mailbox or from us saying join the wrench group. We're very fortunate that we've got a really good platform with great partners who have a lot of connections throughout the industry. I think folks know who we are. So most of our deals are proprietary in nature. We're not very aggressive while we're out. We don't buy for the sake of buying. We're more focused on organic growth and doing all the things to make us a stronger business. And then we use M&A as icing on the cake. And so we're not as aggressive. We're not going to go out and do 20 deals a year or 15 deals, not even 10 deals a year. We're going to do a handful of deals that we want to do in markets that we've got identified. And then we'll go after those, or we'll connect with them, and hopefully we have a proprietary deal versus, getting a call from a banker and there's five or six private equity owned folks in there, and it's a big long auction process. It's typically not what we do. We like to set our sights on a specific business and a market, and then have some conversations with them. And fortunately, with the relationships we have, it's typically not a problem finding the businesses we want to partner with.
Great. All right. Well, Ken, thanks for taking the time today. It's a very interesting trend in the HVAC industry that is multi-layered. So it's good to get someone to kind of talk us through it. So really appreciate you taking the time, Ken.
Happy to. Anytime. Thanks, Kyle.